Welcome to the Future of Pharma with ISP Boston, where I talk to the thought leaders of the pharmaceutical industry about where our industry is headed and what you can do about it. I'm your host, Samir Gondalia. Thanks for joining us today.
My guest today is Brian Hagopian, who is known as, or at least I call him, the Kevin Bacon of Boston life sciences industry. Either you know him or you know someone else who knows him. He's currently the president of Clearwater Consulting and received his chemistry degree from Colgate University. He has over 35 years of design, manufacturing, and operational experience, and he is also very highly sought after high purity water subject matter expert. Brian is an instructor at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, and he's also a Massachusetts certified instructor offering licensing courses for industrial wastewater operators. Brian is the past president of the ISP Boston Area Chapter. And if you have had ever an opportunity to attend one of ISP Boston Area Chapter's product show at Gillette Stadium, he was one of the few key instrumental people to make that happen the very first year, few years back. Not surprisingly, Brian is one of the six people to have received the Hank Moss Lifetime Achievement Award for significant contributions to the Boston chapter and the life sciences industry. For me, Brian has been a friend and a mentor. In this interview, we talk about his beginning as an entrepreneur and all the excitement and challenges that come with that, how the industry has changed over the years, and where it's headed. You'll also hear some nuggets about how to build your professional career, develop new skills, and why hard work will outperform everything else every single time. Hope you enjoy this talk from a very generous individual who's always given more than he has received. Here's Brian Hagopian. Hi, Brian. How are you doing today? Thanks for joining.
Happy to be here, Samir.
So first of all, so your career is very interesting. You are in the water, high purity water. That's not a career, Brian. That's an element, right? You work with an element. And you started working for someone else. Then you became an entrepreneur. You started your own company. You built the company. You sold the company. And now you are like the Yoda of the high purity water industry, at least in New England. So help us fill some blanks and walk us through your journey, you know, about what made you start a business, how was that, and maybe if you can tell us a little bit about importance of high purity water, life science, Boston, and, you know, all that good stuff.
Well, thank you, Samir. You're very kind with your compliments. I very much appreciate them. I feel as though, to kind of take a step back a little bit, I've had entrepreneurial blood in, you know, running through my veins for a lot of my life. My dad started his own business, and I always felt in some way, shape, or form that that I would end up, you know, starting and running my own business. Early on in my career, I had a degree in chemistry with a minor in biology. I got involved in, interestingly, some DNA research with the self-proclaimed original biotech company called Collaborative Research, located in Waltham, Massachusetts. But
please tell me this was in 70s or 80s.
This was in the late 70s. Yes. This was in the late 70s. And I ended up switching career paths a few times pretty early in my career, and I ended up in the water business as, you know, working for another company. The thing that attracted me at the time to the business was the fact that I considered it a relatively technical field that was populated by people who weren't particularly technical. So I felt as though using my chemistry and biology background, I could master this field pretty quickly, and it would allow me the opportunity to stand out amongst my peers and become successful.
And it did,
you know, interestingly, and, you know, one thing as an entrepreneur, you're always looking out for opportunities. And I found myself kind of doing this. And, you know, one lesson learned that I always share with people is You know, you have to be in the game in order for things, you know, for good things to happen to you. You can't be standing on the sideline and expect things to happen. So
right.
I worked for a number of years as a, for lack of a better way to describe it, commissioned salesman for another company. And what it meant was that my salary was tied to my performance. And in fact, at this point in my career, that was something I very much wanted. And, you know, I learned my field pretty quickly. I thought I could learn it very quickly, but it took a lot longer than I expected to learn it and become proficient at it. But after, you know, working for a number of years and after traveling with in circles that involved, you know, people who generally were salespeople, they went out in the field and sold equipment. I found that most of the people who did the same things that I did were really after the big sale. And interestingly, once they made the sale, they kind of didn't really care about what happened to the client afterwards. And, you know, to me, I kind of looked at this a little differently. I had a, you know, I just, if when you, you know, when you make a sale, a client trusts you enough to award a contract to you. And I felt it was incumbent on me to make sure that I continued to earn their trust. And one of the things about water purification equipment is that as people use water, they have, they require services, whether they're calibration services, cleaning services, sanitization services, or consumable items. And if you made friends with these clients and took good care of them, they would have no reason to shop anyplace else. And I found I was pretty much unique in this attitude. Everybody else kind of went off and looked for the next sale. And I instead focused on not only, you know, continuing to find new clients, but to keep the ones that I had satisfied. And that actually formed the business model for the company that I started, a company called Fluid Solutions. It was an approach. And interestingly, when I related this approach to a bank that we had approached for some financing, you know, it was one of those things where bang, bang, they quickly saw the value of what it was, the service that we were trying to offer. And, you know, literally in 2 days, I got an okay. So it was pretty exciting. But I hope I answered your question.
No, Brian, no, you did answer the question. And I think you just mentioned a few nuggets, which I'll highlight, right? You mentioned that unless you are in the game, particularly if you want to be prosperous and if you're an entrepreneur, you have to have your skin in the game. I think it Confucius who said that, and I'm paraphrasing here, is reading is better than listening and doing is better than reading, right? So if you are in the game, you learn. You also mentioned about accountability and commissioning. And it's amazing to this day, I find that how underrated and undervalued the concept of customer service is. You mentioned that you know, happy customer is a lifelong customer, right? So these are some really good lessons for entrepreneurs. And what is the... So what were the challenges when you went into your business? It seemed that you already had professional reputation, so it must not be very difficult. But there are challenges when you're on your own and you don't know that you are going to have a steady stream of paycheck.
Yes, I'll be honest with you. The decision to start a company, the timing in which it happened was pretty sudden. And you know, it was something that I thought eventually was going to be, you know, that eventually it was going to happen. But when I was in this commission sales position, I actually liked it. You know, the company that I worked for had all this support structure in place behind me. And all I had to do was go out and find, you know, find clients interested in our services and convince them that we were the best, and I had a whole team behind me to execute the work. As it turned out in practice, the more successful I became, the harder and more difficult it was for the support structure behind me to, for lack of a better way to describe it, to keep up with me.
Okay.
So, you know, in an effort to satisfy my clients, I would end up getting phone calls that, you know, my service department, you know, wasn't communicative, or, you know, they were falling down in one aspect or another. And I ended up devoting a lot of my time to support functions that were supposed to be provided to me. And
because you were the, for them, you were the face of the company, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's correct. That's correct. And I, you know, I reached a point where, you know, there was finally the straw that broke the camel's back. And I said, well, you know, my thinking was that I had all this support structure behind me, and that's turning out not to be the case. So if I'm doing all the engineering and sales and customer relations stuff, and I'm doing all the support, why am I, you know, why am I working for somebody else? This is
right. It's like you're doing three jobs and you're getting only one paycheck.
Correct. So, you know, so that's when I decided to kind of strike out on my own. Now, I mentioned it was kind of sudden, and, you know, normally this would be something that would be planned, and there'd be some, you know, kind of cash reserves to see us through, you know, the challenging times. Mm-hmm. But this kind of happened really quickly. We were in the process of expecting child number three, and we literally built an addition onto the back of our house, and we mistakenly paid cash for it. You know, we had cash in the bank, and we said, okay, let's do that. And then, you know, really just a month or two later, you know, we decided to, you know, we had that straw that broke the camel's back, and decided to start the business. And in hindsight, I wished we had not spent that $40K in cash, because it would have really helped with cash flow. You know, some of the biggest struggles in the beginning are you always tend to underestimate how much money and how much time things are going to take. So, you know, we had to put our house on the line to start this business. That was the only, you know, that was the only tangible asset that we could provide to the bank in the event that you know, things went south to secure the loan. So, you know, our house went on, you know, as as collateral. And so, you know, we, of course, ran the risk of, if the business failed, you know, we could lose our house. So there was a lot of motivation to be successful. But, you know, honestly, we lived hand to mouth for probably about 2.5 years. And it wasn't until about 3.5 years that we had built a base of enough customers with enough ongoing repetitive business where, you know, we were able to look at the business and say, okay, this is going to work. We know this is going to work, you know. So it was a 3.5 year, I won't say struggle, but it was very challenging. It was very challenging.
That's a long time, particularly with little kids.
Yes.
I have two kids, you know, as you know, 12 and 7, and it's so difficult to explain them the concept of not having something. Like, oh, you can't have that. Like, why not? Oh, well, it's not about money, but you shouldn't have that. But anyway, it's a long time with three kids and business. I'm sure it wasn't 40 hours per week thing. I'm sure it was much more involved.
No, and in fact, there was an article, and I don't think I have it anymore, that somebody wrote about me in the Boston Globe, and it basically talked about, you know, an entrepreneur who works, you know, 60 to 70 to 80 hours a week. And because there are little kids at home, what I would do, the business was very close to where I lived. So at 5 o'clock, I would head home, have dinner with my kids, read stories, put them to bed, and then I'd shoot back to work and do, you know, some of the work that I had. So I got to spend some time with, you know, with my children and my family.
Right. I was talking to an uncle of my friend, and I was telling him, you know, it's about my job and, you know, all that stuff. And I said, yeah, it's, you know, Monday to Friday, you know, mostly 30 to 5, 40 hours. And he was a businessman in India. And he said, 40 hours per week, huh? I remember my first part-time job. Because he built so many businesses. And as you mentioned, right, you know, when you're an entrepreneur, you put 60, 80 hours. So 40 hours just seems like part-time. About water, and I want to talk more about the water and technical aspect itself, because that is such an unglamorous part of, but very important part of our world, life science world, right? But it's like people don't talk about it. It's like something in the background. You turn on the tap and water is there. But, you know, if you don't have that water quality and all the right equipment and purification process in place, it can shut down. And it has shut down the facilities. We are always tell us about the challenges of what mistakes the stakeholders, life science companies, and you also work with other high tech companies such as semiconductors, and what mistakes do they make? What do they just take it for granted? And challenges, and you know, how do you, after your experience, how do you help them now?
Well, you know, I would say I was fortunate to be around and running my, you know, new fledgling business when the biotech boom hit the New England mm-hmm. area. I was fortunate to make friends. Again, this is all about being in the game. You know, I made friends with several, both engineering companies and consulting firms. And I was able to demonstrate to them that I had, you know, enough technical knowledge in the field so that they could come to me with a requirement and I could mm-hmm. figure out exactly what they needed and offer them a solution. It ended up being very helpful to us as a company. And, you know, some of the challenges, of course, you know, began with working for companies that were basically laboratory-based companies that came out of universities and had a great idea and wanted to then get into, you know, they'd started the research and they wanted to kind of take the next step in the process. Mm-hmm. And once they got a little bit further along, then they needed to develop a product. They needed a pharmaceutical grade of water. And, you know, I came out of a research environment with them. And all of a sudden I found I needed to learn about, oh, what's this pharmaceutical grade water? And and all of the things, you know, and it's interesting now because now I've spent a lot of time and I've learned a lot about the field. But back then, there really wasn't much talk about it in the circles that I was traveling in because it was mostly a research environment. And only slowly did some of these companies realize, hey, we need to become, you know, real pharmaceutical companies. And they started throwing out words like, you know, validation and documentation right. and, you know, and all this stuff at the time was foreign to me. So
right. not only so you,
I,
you know,
I had, just, to, I had just, to learn yeah. a lot of things. You know, our facility, and in fact, I laugh now because we would have auditors come to our facility and ask us questions. And, you know, some of my initial reactions were, why are you asking me these kinds of questions? And interestingly,
Is that because you did not think they were important, or were you surprised that they were going into such level of details?
No, I didn't really, you know, how do I want to describe it? I'm a big systems guy. So okay. if I can understand the system, then I can understand the pressure points and I can understand what things are going to be expected of me. And some of these questions just came out of left field. But, right. you know, interestingly, some 10 or 15 years later, I went through a program that a credential program that ISPE put together, which unfortunately no longer exists, but it was the Certified Pharmaceutical Industry yeah. Professional Program. And through that program, I came to understand and appreciate why the quality people were asking what I considered at the time, all these stupid questions. And, right. And I had a good laugh because one of the auditors that had come to the facility, you know, they come to my facility and asked all these questions, was in one of these classes. And I remember going over to her laughingly and saying, now I understand why you were asking me all these questions. So, it's been a learning process. It continues to be a learning process.
Right.
You know, the field is evolving. You know, there are old facilities that are looking to be upgraded. There are brand new facilities that are being constructed. You know, there are all sorts of things in various levels of compliance with current industry best practices. So, you know, people are always looking to make improvements while ensuring that they produce good product in a, you know, as economical a way as possible.
Right. And truth be told, Brian, also in the 80s, while you and the small pharmaceutical companies, right, with two MIT guys and a professor, while you guys were learning about all these things, FDA was also learning about all these things, right? They were creating the regulations as the science and the field was developing. So that must have been a very interesting time.
And it's interesting because I did not travel in the circles at that time, although I do now. But I did not travel.
I think now you are the Kevin Bacon of the Boston life science.
Well, I'm not.
Because at least for me, because everyone knows everyone through you. So,
well, you know, and interestingly, at the time, the pharmaceutical industry had testing requirements for pharmaceutical water that were wet chemistry based and qualitative only. They really did, you know, they were go, no go tests. Take a sample of water, put three drops of this in, add one drop of this, swirl it around, hold it up to a light, and if it's clear, you pass. And if it's cloudy or what they call opalescent, it's a failure. Okay, so
okay, it's very subjective. So,
it was very qualitative, very subjective, and you know, the U.S. Pharmacopeia put together an expert water committee to look at some of these test methods and the things that were being tested for. And, you know, there were a whole bunch of things that were being tested for. And the methodology was stuff that, you know, when you looked in the history books, some of the stuff was developed back in 1890. So, you know, so
before
so
even again, FDA.
this expert committee looked at things and said, well, we can greatly simplify what's being tested. We can take advantage of instrumentation that exists right now. And that's where the current requirements for TOC and conductivity came into play, along with endotoxin for pharmaceutical grade water. There were 9 or 10 or 11 separate tests for things like sulfates and chlorides and ammonia and heavy metals and oxidizable substances and pH. There were a lot of things going on a couple of different fronts, both, you know, locally as the biotech business was beginning to evolve, and you know, on a larger level with you know, the FDA and the U.S. pharmacopeia and the pharmaceutical industry.
Now, with that, you know, we talked about how we got to the current point where we are, you know, over the last few years or few decades. Is that all, or do you still see an opportunity that this field, this particular water field, you know, how we use it, how we taste it, incorporate that in our system? What are the changes or improvements that I think we are looking at over the next few years, or is that all be all?
I will tell you that, you know, my thinking is that this field evolves almost on a monthly basis. There are changes that are happening in the field that will impact what is done. There are new purification processes being developed. In fact, many pharmacopoeias up until just recently said, we will approve only water for injection systems based on distillation. Well, the United States Pharmacopeia softened their position initially by, and I think they did this mistakenly, by saying that two-pass RO would be okay before the technology was really proven and understood. And but again, I digress a little bit, but the pharmacopoeias are now, the regulatory agencies are now realizing that, hey, we consider distillation the gold standard, but there may be other processes capable of producing water of sufficient quality to meet the requirements for injectable grade water. In fact, I will tell you, the microelectronics industry does it all the time, and they don't distill anything. So in terms of, there are advances in the field, they happen all the time. Probably the biggest, most exciting area where these things are happening is in the area of rapidly detecting bacteria. Bacteria obviously are, you know, are one of the major contaminants that people are concerned with in a pharmaceutical water system. And the current methodology has several issues. The first one being it takes 5 to 7 days from when you begin a culture to when you have a result.
So we're talking about bioburden, right?
And we're talking about bioburden, that's right. And you know, the second major issue is, and everybody pretty much understands, that regardless of the test method that you use, there may be some living bacteria that you do not detect with your test method. So there's a lot of, there are a lot of companies developing technologies right now that allow you to more rapidly detect the presence of bacteria. Some people have shortened that 5 to 7 days to 2 to 3 days with their technology. Other companies,
how reliable is that though?
I'm sorry?
How reliable is that? I mean, there is a reason why we do it for 5 days, right? We need to culture it. But if we do it in 2 days, we reach a sufficient point on the curve to culture enough bacteria?
Well, look at it this way. If you find a bacteria and you capture it and you put it into a medium where it's going to grow, it'll start to divide and multiply. And the reason that the test is done for 5 to 7 days is it takes that long for a visibly apparent dot to develop so that you can see it.
Okay. Now you can do it quicker.
There are techniques that, you know, that basically are, and again, I'm definitely oversimplifying, but that use, you know, for all intents and purposes, a microscope or a magnifying glass to scan and be able to find smaller dots.
Okay.
There are other techniques that measure, for example, things that fluoresce. There's a technology that's been around for a long time called epifluorescence, and its drawback is that it can be used to detect both living and dead bacteria, but unfortunately, it doesn't distinguish between the two.
Okay.
So you can tell is something there, yes or no, but you can't tell if it's alive or not. There are other techniques that are currently being manufactured and that are currently being improved upon literally on a month-by-month basis that are able to almost give you instantaneous information. They shine a light source through at a particular wavelength. They look for something to fluoresce that's associated with a living organism.
Mm-hmm.
And they detect it. Now, the biggest challenge from a quality control standpoint, you know, from the perspective of the pharmaceutical manufacturer, is that many of these techniques destroy the bacteria that they're detecting as part of the detection process. And whenever the quality function finds a living bacteria, the first step is speciate. Let's figure out what species this bacteria is to help us determine. Right, to help us determine where did it come from? Was it in the water? Did it get introduced during the sampling process? Or for any other reason? So there are some challenges right now, but this technology is rapidly evolving, and it's pretty exciting. You know, for somebody who's, you know, grown up and lived with waiting 5 to 7 days for a bacteria result, just the fact that you could potentially get a result in 10 minutes, it's unbelievable. It's you know, it's it's going to change the industry. And for the better.
Yeah. And not just the pharmaceutical industry. I think I see better usage in the hospital industry where you are waiting for infections or sepsis or that sort of diagnosis. And if you can diagnose that, you know, there's bacteria or no bacteria, then that will end up saving literally a lot of lives. We talked about bacteria. What about the virus with all this COVID situation going on? I think the first known instance of COVID last year they found was in sewage water, right? So it was in sewage water. And it might be totally unrelated and the answer is no, there is no impact. But is there, are we talking about virus in water or is it going to have any impact, or are the regulators, or, you know, are they more cognizant that, oh, we should also look at this thing?
Well, I think, you know, you may know from some of the work that you've done professionally, typically if there's a biomanufacturing process that involves cells, there's a step of virus inactivation.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. There's a step of virus removal. So, you know, we understand enough about viruses, what size they are and what they do, to make sure they don't interfere with, you know, the pharmaceutical manufacturing processes. The, you know, COVID-19 has thrown a curveball into just about everything. It's a virus that's transmitted through aerosols. And, you know, there are guidelines that say 6 feet minimum social distancing, you should be wearing a mask, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I also, and I'm not sure you know this, but I'm also, not only am I connected with the water purification side of the business, I also do a lot of work on the wastewater treatment side of the business.
That was my next question about your course, but please go on.
I mean, I'm a licensed operator in the state of Massachusetts, and I do, operator training for people looking to get and to keep their licenses. And, you know, I've been to some of the local municipal wastewater treatment plants, and because I'm a licensed operator, you know, I see all the, for lack of a better way to describe it, chatter and concern about people who work at wastewater treatment plants, because in fact, yes, human waste does contain coronavirus. And right. So people working at wastewater treatment plants have to be extremely careful in how they proceed, because of course there's a lot of flowing water. There are aeration processes where they're intentionally bubbling air through some of the water. So
it's microorganism heaven. It's everything
yes,
they need.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Air nutrition, warmth, perfect 36 degree temperature and all that good stuff.
Right.
So this is a really nice segue. My next question, what I wanted to talk to you about, that 20 hours industrial wastewater training class that you did. And before we go into that, we have, you know, lots of listeners who are, you know, like you, who are veterans of the industry, right? So you spent decades in the industry, you acquired this knowledge, you had this knowledge and urge to share this with the people who might need them. So not just the course, but the entrepreneurship part of it too, right? How did you, because it's a 20 hours course, Brian, and it must have taken you months, if not years, to record all that. So the goal setting, why did you do that? Which different platforms did you look at to put this course out? So if you can walk us through that process, that'd be great.
Well, so let me start at the beginning with that. When I was an entrepreneur in the fledgling stage of the company Fluid Solutions that I had formed, and the biotech industry was booming, I built some pretty close relationships with some prestigious consulting firms that helped the majority of biotech companies who wanted to kind of spin out of universities and kind of start operations on their own, do so. And after working with them for a couple of years, one of the people approached me and said, "Hey, Brian, we love what you do for our water purification systems, but we can't seem to find anybody like you on the wastewater treatment side of things. Would you be willing to design and build pH neutralization systems for us? So I looked at it a little bit and I said, seems pretty straightforward. Tanks, mixers, chemical injection, all chemistry. I can figure this out. So, you know, that literally ended up being a new section of business that, because I was asked to do it, we ended up getting involved in it. Now, like I told you early on, as I was working with some of these fledgling companies, I didn't really understand what the requirements of the pharmaceutical industry were at the time, because I didn't, you know, there wasn't a lot of pharma up in this area. I really didn't understand the requirements for neutralization systems, and I was able to design and build them technically, but I very quickly learned that, oh my goodness, in order to operate these systems, you need a license in the state of Massachusetts. Okay. So as soon as I figured that out, and that happened right away, you know, I went to sign up for a course offered by the state of Massachusetts to get you ready to take the licensing exam. So I went to sign up for the course, and it turns out the course was full. So I'd have to wait because of the way that the testing worked. They only did two tests a year. And I wasn't ready to wait 6 to 9 months to, you know, to get my license. Right. So I found the reference textbook. I read it myself, and I went and I took the exam. And I realized, because I ran a service-based business, that any of my techs that would be servicing this equipment should have their licenses. So being the, how do I want to describe this, thrifty business owner that I was, I didn't, you know, I didn't want to pay to have 12 of my guys go out and take a class with somebody that may or may not enable them to pass the exam. So I said, I'll develop, I went through and I kind of taught myself, I know what the material is. So let me develop a couple of PowerPoint presentations to go through all this material. In the course of developing this, these presentations, a light bulb went on, and I said, gee, I wonder if I can apply to the state of Massachusetts and get approval for this as a state certified class. And I went ahead and I found out what I needed to do, and I went and I did that. I've been teaching the class ever since it's been coming up on almost 20 years now. And when I retired from my, the water equipment sales and service business, I opened a consulting business, the business that I'm in right now. And one of the things that I offer is I continue to offer this in-person training, but I always had the idea that at some point in time, I'd love to be able to offer an online version, because, you know, I would offer these classes to my clients, and a lot of people would come back to me and say, oh, you know, I'd love to take it, but I can't make it fit with my schedule. So I thought an online course would be an interesting way to satisfy that need. I'm not sure if you want me to kind of talk about that process at all.
Yeah, sure. Which different platforms did you look at? Why did you choose this? There are so many different platforms, right? You could put it on Udemy, you can put it on, you know, premium YouTube, or how did the business side of the course went on?
Well, I ended up picking a platform called Teachable. You know, one of the things that there was a lot involved. I mean, I'm a one-man operation. So I do the filming, I do the editing, I generate the PowerPoint presentations, I generate the videos, I produce everything. And, you know, one of the things I realized early on is that there's a lot of kind of back office stuff that's required in order to kind of make everything work. And one of the lessons I learned early on in life is know what you're good at and focus on that. Don't dilute your efforts with other things. So while I was confident that I could probably figure out all the stuff that I needed to in order to administer this on my own website, I realized that, listen, that's not really what I'm good at. It takes enough time to generate and produce high quality content I didn't want to worry about all the other little things and how the websites work and, you know, all these little changes that happen every month and keeping up with all that stuff. So I went looking for a platform. And, you know, like you said, there are lots of platforms. There's, you know, there's Udemy, there's Lynda, there's the platform I use is Teachable, there's Thinkific, and there's definitely a bunch more. You know, one thing I will tell you is I'm usually pretty thorough in my research. So as I was going through and building the capability to actually make online videos, I had to learn about software, I had to learn about hardware, I had to get the right, you know, computer with the right processing speed. I needed video equipment, audio equipment, and a small studio, which, you know, which I have, and lighting, and, you know, I realized that a lot of the kind of the back office stuff, the things that I needed to integrate, were better for me to say, I'm gonna put these courses up on a site that already has this platform in place. In fact, I'm glad you're asking this question. As it turns out, somebody who went to college with my oldest son was one of the first 10 employees in a company called Wistia. They do all sorts of back office analytics for a lot of sites. And at one of my son's birthdays, we rented out a suite at the TD North Garden to watch a Celtics game. And my son connected me with this other guy, and I ended up having a conversation with him and asking him about the platforms that he would recommend. And he pointed me to, you know, two or three of them. I looked at them and I ended up, you know, and I picked the platform that I'm using right now. But I also concurrently spent time working with the Board of Certification of the state of Massachusetts to make sure that they understood what I was doing and that I understood their requirements. So, for example, if my course was approved to issue 20 hours, that I could actually prove that somebody spent 20 hours in front of a computer in an online course. Okay. So there were definitely, you know, numerous challenges, to putting that together, but, you know, I'm happy to say that my first beta version of the course was released in the fall of 2019 before the word COVID-19 even became a word.
Right. So this course is certified by the Massachusetts, state of Massachusetts. So if someone can take this course, the person can take the exam, right?
Correct.
Right. And I also want to point out one thing. So you traded the administrative headache for revenue sharing for the entrepreneurs out there, right? You are sharing revenue with the platform, but you also don't have to deal with the mundane admin work, and you can focus on creating technical material, which you are really good at. So, Brian, what would be, so let's change the tech. Let's talk about some non-technical stuff. What would you advise to the young professionals starting out in our field right now? I know you were very passionate about the student chapter for ISP Boston area. And it's actually, you know, you brought it, you made it what it is today. Our good friend George West is carrying the work that you did. What would you advise to young professionals starting out right now with the current situation, market, COVID, and looking at future? How can they, what would the best way to start their career?
Well, you know, interestingly, the young professionals in the Boston chapter approached me and asked me if I would do a talk for them as part of the just completed October Educational Summit.
Oh, perfect. And then you can give us Cliff's Notes version of your presentation.
And so the talk, you know, they said, listen, you can talk about water, or we know you've done a lot of things with students and young professionals. If there's something you want to do on that line, you know, go right ahead. So I did a webinar on things I wish I had learned when I was a young professional, stuff that I had to end up learning on my own that nobody taught me about. that I found, you know, that I would suggest that people, you know, it would be great had I known this a little bit sooner. Okay. And, you know, I talked about things, you know, simple stuff to start off with. And, you know, the first is, and it's interesting because a lot of people aren't, you know, many people are, but a lot of people aren't brought up this way to have an attitude that, hey, listen, I always have to make sure I live my life in the black. If I have any big plans, if I have things I want to do, I need to be planning for them now. So
don't put it on credit card.
No, don't put it on credit. You know, and interestingly, when I was, you know, when I was running my business, I would find very interesting lunchtime conversation amongst some of the people that worked with us. And they would talk about how they couldn't buy anything more because they've maxed their credit cards out and they can, you know, and all they're trying to do is keep up with their interest payments. And,
right.
And I said, oh my goodness, somebody hasn't really shown these people, you know, how to,
right.
how to kind of run their lives. And
yeah, it's just like, you see some of these kids, I'll just add my 2 cents. You see this, some of the young people, they use credit card as if it's the money in the bank, like as if like they're using a debit card. It's like, no, this is not like just your credit card balance should always be zero. You can spend $10,000 if you're going to pay it off that month without any interest. Credit card is not your bank account. It's not your debit card. There's a difference.
And you know, it is. It's so easy because right. It is a credit card. You can just, you know, they'll give you credit because, you know, frankly, they love to charge you 18 or 24% interest. That's how they make money. you know, and it's just so easy because, you know, you don't, I mean, it's interesting because, when I was younger and this was a long time ago, you know, you'd get a paycheck, you'd bring it to the bank, you'd put a portion of your check in the bank and you'd take the rest as cash. And that would be your, you know, you'd buy groceries that way. You'd do, you know, you'd buy gasoline that way. I mean, it wasn't, you know, we weren't nearly as much of a credit-based society. Right. So you had a constant reminder as to whether you were spending too much money because you'd run out of cash.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And yeah. And with, you know, with us now being a credit economy, it's just so easy to overspend and be careful about it. I mean, one of the rules that I always had is, you know, unless there's a very, very good reason to do this, at the end of every month, I will make sure my credit card balance is zero. I don't want to be owing any money that's going to carry over to the next month because then there are processing fees, interest charges, and all sorts of other things that they get you on. And right. You can't let that happen. You're never going to get ahead.
No, that is actually so interesting. You should say that about young people and debt, because that is often underrated, such an underrated subject, right? You know, terrorism is overrated. You know, stress is underrated. Deficit and debt at the federal level or global economy, that's overrated. But your monthly budget management, that is so underrated. Because of this COVID, we don't go out as much. But, you know, when you used to go out and you see in that corner, there's this 20-year-old kid who walks in and he plucks down his credit card and he says, first round on me. I'm like, oh, don't do that. Just don't put it on credit card, and you know, you don't have to buy drinks to your other friends, and that's just like such a bad way. That is often important, right? Because if you are in debt, then it's a drag.
Well, you know, so what I to continue along the line of you know, some things that I would tell young professionals, you know, number one is get a hold of your financial situation and get it under control. If you can do that, you'll be amazed as to how much better you will feel and how much more confident you will feel as a person. Okay. Then from there, one of the things, and again, at different, you know, people are at different stages and these things mean different things to different people at different times. I found early in my career that because I was in a client-facing situation, I was involved in negotiation all the time. And people are, regardless of whether you do this or not, but you know, I had a couple of things happen to me where, you know, I ended up making a deal with somebody or coming to agreement. And then, you know, a day or two later, I realized like, wait a minute, I shouldn't have agreed to that, you know, and I didn't realize, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And I didn't know why it happened. So I said, okay. And I went looking for resources on, how to negotiate.
Okay.
So,
oh, wow.
You know, that's something that actually helped me a lot. Some of the different approaches, many of which did not fit with my personality style, but, it was important for me to recognize and understand that people would try to use these tactics on me. And it gave me the, it gave me information on what do I do when somebody does this? You know, how do I react? And I became a much better negotiator. And the other advice that I gave to the young professionals is to make plans, set goals. And I walk through the process by which you do that. And this can be for setting long-term goals, short-term goals, you know, intermediate goals, career-long goals.
If you don't have goals, you are not going to get there, right? You can't shoot something if you don't know what you are going to be shooting at. So that's
right. It gives you a target. That's correct.
Right. If you miss the goal, at least you'll be in the same direction if you know which side the goals are. If you had to, Brian, give a TED talk on a subject outside of water, right? Because there are so many webinars already by you. What would be the topic you choose for a potential TED talk?
Oh, you know, that's a great question and one I'm not sure I have an answer to. You know, one thing that I think I'm passionate about because I've been involved in, you know, super high purity pharmaceutical grade water for so long. I'd like to, you know, the altruist in me would like to maybe put something together to help educate the general public on drinking water safety. Mm. And some of the things that I've learned being in the field that I'm in as to whether people should be worried about A, B, C, or D. You know, I've seen some of the claims that companies make about products that they sell and, you know, some of them are very misleading. So that would be something that, you know, that would be something that I think, you know, would be a good topic to talk about. Other than that, it, you know, something along the lines of entrepreneurial spirit, how to, you know, keep a positive attitude in the face of, you know, what may be stressful and challenging times. Those are probably some of the things that I think I would look toward.
That topic about water and the mess about educating them about the water quality, I think that could be a good topic because there is lots of misinformation. It's not that people don't know enough. It's just that people believe so many things which are just not true, if you don't mind me saying in current time, right? People are so sure of the things which you know is not true. You can point to a, you know, number or a scientific principle and say, well, that's not true. But definitely, I think we can use some of the, you know, truth from an expert. Mm-hmm. When you were growing up, Brian, or even today, who were your role models? And what do you, like, real historical fiction, how did they affect your worldview, your career choices?
Let's see. I think in terms of people who I idolize, being from the Boston area, and I'm gonna say a name that probably will divulge how old I am. one of my big idols was a sports figure by the name of Bill Russell. He's in his 80s right now, and he was the center for the Boston Celtics back in the 50s and 60s when they won 11 championships in 13 years.
Okay.
He was everything of a team player. He didn't care about statistics. All of the things that he stood for, I have tried to emulate. And he's just probably the greatest winner of all times. I think somebody published a book, Bill Simmons published a book about the top 500 basketball players of all times, and next to Michael Jordan, he was number two.
Oh, okay. Well, he's in good company.
So it's very good company. He revolutionized the game, and You know, somebody asked him a question about, you know, all these centers now who, when they block a shot, you know, love to block it and send it into the crowd, block it out of bounds. And what he thought about that. And he said, you know, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard of. Why don't you, you know, you're stopping the clock. You just interrupted a play, block it to one of your guards and start a fast break and go get points. What are you doing?
Right.
So that's probably the one that, you know, if there was somebody that I idolized that I'd like to meet, that's the guy that I'd like to meet.
He can't be too far from you. You're in Boston too.
I don't think he's in Boston. I think he's in Seattle now. I don't think
he's
here.
Okay. It's a little difficult to get to these days. Which books do you recommend to others?
So
or the books that influence you?
Let me tell you, it varied depending on where I was in my career. I'm kind of a self-help guy. If I can, you know, watch something now or, you know, read something in days gone by, that'll help me. I will do that. I'll be honest and tell you, I don't do a lot of reading for pleasure. Usually I'll want to learn about something. And that will kind of direct most of my reading, but, you know, and again, depending on where I was in my career, that would kind of dictate, what I would read. You know, I mentioned earlier that I think it's a good idea to understand a little bit more about negotiations. So I've read books, and again, I'm dating myself. I got a cassette tape based series on negotiating that I would listen to in my car.
Do you still have a cassette player?
No, that's long gone. In fact, I have a few cassettes that I'm now trying to digitize before. Before we can't use them anymore. But
yeah, my wife and I were, by the way, talking, you know, a couple of few days back, and I mentioned, you know, audio cassette, and our 7-year-old daughter is like, "What's an audio cassette?"
I'm
like,
"Yes, exactly.
I am old, but please go
exactly,
ahead."
Exactly. But you know, in terms of some of the books that I've recently read, you know, I've read a couple of Malcolm Gladwell books called Outliers and The Tipping Point that kind of help explain, you know, how, the 10,000 hour thing. Earlier in my career, I found I was great in small groups. I was great when talking to groups of 3 or 4 people. But if I found I'd have to make a presentation to 16 people, I would freeze up. So I ended up taking a Dale Carnegie course in public speaking that helped me tremendously. Mm. You know,
you did take that course. That's nice. Do they still offer it?
I am sure that they do. Although I'm sure now it's all kind of online; it's not in person. But
I think
it was, you know,
when they ask Warren Buffett the single factor responsible for his success, he pointed to the Dale Carnegie course in public speaking.
Well, you know, it helps with a lot of things. It helps with confidence, self-confidence, and attitude. And I think, you know, attitude is one of the most important things. Some of the other things that I've read recently is a book by, I believe it's Daniel Kahneman, called Thinking Fast and Slow, that kind of is a psychology of how the brain works. As I've been working on developing some online courses, I've wanted to understand a little bit more about kind of what makes people think, and things like winning with people, how to tell good stories, by, you know, a bunch of different authors. And interestingly, I'm realizing that I'm going to need to become somewhat conversant in various social medias. So I'm starting to learn about, you know, what different media platforms are valuable and helpful for some of the things I might want to do.
That's actually social media in business. It's going to be, I don't think the professional world, the marketers know this, but, you know, very serious businesses like banking or pharmaceutical industry, you don't see a lot of presence there on social media. And I find that very interesting. They still consider it juvenile, but all the business is going to be there. If not all the business, all the advertising, because that's where all the eyeballs are. That's where all the attention is. So if you want to get your message out, you're going to have to learn how to talk on social media, hopefully.
Right, right.
Hopefully these businesses will do that. Any quotes that your favorite quotes that you find inspiring or that you live by?
Well, let's see. One of the things I remember a lot of people saying to me when we would, you know, a lot of my, I guess, my peers slash competitors would say to me when I was in the equipment sales business, is they would say, geez, Brian, you're so lucky. I don't know how you get all these jobs. You're really lucky. And actually a saying that I live by is the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Yeah, so true.
Ultimately, what it comes down to is there ain't no free lunch. If you want to get ahead, you need to outwork the next guy. One thing I will tell you is, you know, you're always going to be able to find people smarter than you. You're always going to be able to find people faster than you. You're always going to be able to find people better than you. But if you're willing to outwork them, there are so many brilliant underachievers in this world. You know, and I go back to a story like the tortoise and the hare, you know, perseverance, stick-to-itiveness, you know, those kinds of things those are the values that will get people ahead in life.
Right. No, I was listening to a recent interview by Naval Ravikant. He is an investor in Silicon Valley, but I was listening to his podcast and he mentioned that the world is full of smart, brilliant, talented, lazy people who don't amount to much. So it doesn't really matter how smart, how brilliant, how talented you are. But if you don't have good work ethics, really, it's wasted.
I'll give you one more quick example of this. When I retired from my full-time job and kind of went into the consulting business, I want to say a month or two later, the people who were kind of acting in my place called me and said, "Hey, would you come in and talk to us? We're shocked, but our phones have stopped ringing. And would you, you know, come and talk to us about, you know, how to kind of work with the community of people that you've been working with?" So I walked in and made a 2-hour presentation to, you know, a half dozen people. And I explained to them the way that I did things. And it was a lot of work. And I could see one person looking over to the next and saying, "Geez, I'll bet you if we did, you know, we could probably do half of that and get almost all of those results." And, you know, before they realized what was happening, they were kind of talking themselves out of putting in all that effort because it's a lot of work. You know, that's where the stick-to-itiveness and the perseverance, you know, will see you through all the time.
Brian, before we say goodbyes, do you have any parting words, any ask, any request to our audience?
Get out there, you know, do what you can to stay in the game. Networking is a challenging thing in this, you know, this day of COVID. But I will tell you probably the best way to do it, because everything's happening virtually, is to volunteer to spend some of your time with a group of people who you believe in and enjoy being with. There's nothing more rewarding. It will put you in with a group of like-minded people who, believe it or not, will help you further on in your career. It's definitely not something that you're going to see a result in a week or two, but it is something that could start paying benefits 3 months, 6 months, a year, 3 years, 5 years down the road. And if you're a long-term player, and I think you should be, you know, there are some actions you can take now to help your status and standing and position and reputation. And don't be afraid to do it. Take the first step.
And I will just add one more thing to what you just said, is that your efforts will be rewarded. You just don't know which effort will be rewarded. So you will have to keep trying in multiple directions. It's a long-term game, as you just mentioned. Well, Brian, thank you so very much for your time, generosity, and sharing your wisdom. And really, really appreciate it.
Thanks, Samir. Great to talk to you.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Be sure to subscribe and let others know word of mouth is our oxygen. Visit www.ispeboston.org for the comprehensive show notes from today's episode and also find out more ways to associate with us. Do let us know your thoughts in the comment section, and if there is someone you'd like to see as a guest on this show, thanks again for joining us today. We'll see you next time.